This is the Longevity Biotech panel at Foresight's Vision Weekend 2023, France edition. Here we have Leon Peshkin, Yui Dagan, Alexandra Singer, and me, Alison Dipman, discussing longevity technologies, possible overvalued versus undervalued technologies on the horizon, and what we can do as a community to help advance the undervalued ones. Enjoy. The first one is longevity biotech. And here I picked a quote from Engines of Creation, from Eric Drexler. And he's asking, when? Which will be the last generation to age and die, and which will be the first to win through? So let's think big on this panel. I'm really, really happy to have Leon. It's like, what? We're not going to make it.
I'm just trying to read the quote.
I'm really happy to have a wonderful panel with us here. So we have Leon Peshkin, who's been a very, very repeat guest at our longevity workshops. He's from Harvard, is working on fantastic stuff on many of them. Alexandra Singer, who's at Altos Labs, and can tell you a lot about the machine learning aspects of longevity biotech. And we have Yui Dagan, who is a previous Foresight Fellow and who's been really working across the board, I think, in the longevity field for quite some time. So maybe just to kick us off, I would love to know from you if you could give us a brief overview. I mean, you know, I've already showed you like in 2017 when we still had our longevity workshops next to a squash room. What has happened like in the past 5 years? How did you see the field change? And then also, what do you think the next 5 years could bring if you were thinking pretty ambitiously? You go first.
All right. Wow. I think, yeah, in the past 5 years, the field has definitely seen a lot of growth, both in terms of public acceptance and funding coming in from investors who want to invest into longevity. I guess Altos Labs is a perfect example of seasoned investors willing to place large bets on longevity. They think, you know, we're close to finding ways that can greatly extend lifespan. And I think in terms of the science over the past 5 years, maybe it hasn't been kind of as fruitful as people hoped.
Oh, spicy.
Well, I mean, no, I think everybody would agree that the optimism we had over the past 5 years wasn't exactly realized. We already had reprogramming, and partial reprogramming is what got Altos Labs started, as well as a few other very well-funded companies. And I think the science is moving in the field of reprogramming and longevity in general is moving forward. But at the same time, I don't think we've had any novel concepts. Like, you know, before reprogramming, we had senolytics killing senescent cells. Before that, we had telomerase, or, you know, lengthening telomeres, or just using telomerase for maybe some other things besides lengthening telomeres. And since reprogramming, we haven't really had, you know, this kind of novel concept emerge. And maybe that's, you know, something that I'd like to see happen.
Do you have any hint for what that could be?
Well, if I knew, I probably would say. But I think the only thing that maybe people are thinking of these days is replacing organs, including replacing the brain, Jean Hébert and other groups. Working on that.
What do you guys think about replacement? Because it's also going to be one of the manifold questions. Who here knows about Jean Hébert, for example, who's also in our community, has done some replacement work? Any spicy takes on replacement? No.
What's replacement?
Replacing organs, basically, instead of trying to stop aging or prevent aging, you replace the organs that have aged. So basically, the ship of Theseus, right? You
Is it different from transplantation? That is it just a new word, or?
Well, it's transplantation is just one organ, but this is the concept that you replace, and maybe even preemptively, like before you have a kidney failure, you just replace your old organs with new ones. And I guess the culmination of that is what they call full body replacement, or just, you know, mm-hmm, transplanting your head or just your brain into either your clone new body or maybe some other.
So sounds like there are two aspects of replacement which are different from transplant. One is when people decide to do it, right? So before it's dramatically bad, you can just opt to have a young kidney. Sounds fantastic if you can do it, if you can get young kidney somewhere. And the other one is we are focused more on artificially creating organs. Right, I don't know what to think about it. It's great if we can actually do it. There are some interesting, there is some interesting new science that I've seen. Right, but probably it's going to be a while. And some organs are much more complex than others. Right, so it's going to come in very gradually. But yeah, I'm hopeful for that.
Oh, brain lasts too bad. What do you think is exciting about the next 5 years? Like, is there any specific research areas that you think are like perhaps undervalued right now?
Well, I guess I will be in my character of also being the oldest guy on stage. I've my PhD was done in artificial intelligence a long time ago. And just like with artificial intelligence, we see this kind of natural life cycle, you know, oh, it's perceptron, never mind. Or it's support vector machine, never mind. Deep learning, that's exciting. And I think it's also going to come to, not to disappear, it will just find its place and we'll have another. Right, but it's not just amazing singularity coming on. Always overhyped. It's the same with longevity. We've seen this, you know, telomeres getting shorter, or well, maybe not so important. Senescent cells, maybe there are no senescent cells. And so we go through this. Right. So certainly new things will come along. And I have certainly been a victim of being terribly excited myself. You know, I was super excited about getting rid of senescent cells, of parabiosis, of many other things, and then kind of calm down. So I'm cautious that, you know, today I'm excited about looking at extracellular matrix and, you know, but ask me in 5 years. One thing I am genuinely excited and do not expect to get unexcited is normalization of the conversation itself. I see steady progress in this just conversation being much more accepted of radically extending life. All right, 20 years ago, you were just a weirdo talking about this. And now everybody is discussing whether it's, you know, bad science or fraudulent business or genuine philosophical discussion. But this is just normal conversation, accepted subject. And that's great.
Yeah. You want to chime in?
I'm personally very interested in some of the stuff on ovarian reserve, but I speak, you know, not as a biologist, so I can't speak to the science of it. But I want to know if, you know, delaying menopause helps. And I'm a very big proponent of surrogacy and artificial wombs.
Do you want to say more on either of those? Artificial
womb
surrogacy?
Well, do either of you have anything to say about those topics?
Artificial wombs. I don't think I have much to say. So, yeah.
Well, there were a few interesting projects in the last year, and then I feel like they also kind of like withered. So I would also love to see some more stuff on that. That would be very helpful for us. There's also a manifold question out on that if you're interested in checking it out. Okay, well, I want to ask you also, like, since you have, I mean, both of you, I think, you know, since you have also some AI expertise, and I guess you also, you know, what do you see like other technologies? Like, how do you see them impacting longevity technology development? I'm sure AI is a big one there, but like, if you want to speak to other fields too, like neurotech, we had a workshop on atomic precision, like the molecular nanotech aspect related to longevity technology. But like, do you see other fields that people are discussing here throughout the weekend impacting that field at all? Are there any useful, any useful bridges?
Sure. Right now, what I'm seeing the most across longevity biotech companies in terms of AI is that AI is acting as a research aid. So for example, you will have LLMs that are summarizing research papers for people, scanning through the literature. So you have LLMs kind of cutting down on how many hours per day a scientist is spending reading versus thinking. And what we're trending towards there is trying to get the LLMs to actually even come up with ideas and talk with them and discuss them more. So you always have something to bounce ideas off of. But I'm very excited about AI kind of going just from being a research aid to predicting more of the experiments that should be done and suggesting new ideas as well.
I got recently asked to contribute a chapter into a volume on artificial intelligence in longevity. And my first response was, you probably don't want my chapter because I think this is an empty set. There is no artificial intelligence in longevity. So they insisted, and the chapter is out. I suggest you read it because through the process of working, I actually think I was able to come up with something constructive. And very briefly, I describe what I call a Mechanical Turk model of AI and longevity. If you're familiar with Mechanical Turk, it's actually a human midget playing chess, pretending to be robotic. So largely today, I think successes of AI in biology and longevity is passing human successes as AI, because the promise is that it's going to scale up massively and give us a plethora of new molecule candidates and all of that. But I am quite excited about what was just mentioned about just large language models helping us summarize the literature and being a very useful assistant with that.
Do you have anything that you're excited about in relationship to other technologies for longevity?
I'm generally excited about AI, and I think, scared and excited, of course. Everybody is scared as well about, you know, uncontrollable AI. But in terms of the science, just watching, you know, GPTs grow exponentially is a word used very frequently, but really, you know, in the past year, the intelligence of GPT, ChatGPT, has grown very, very much. And I think in the next few years, it'll become even smarter, and it will actually tell us what kind of experiments to run, what new data it needs to make inferences. For example, you know, how does aging work? Because obviously human intelligence wasn't good enough to figure it out, but I'm sure AI eventually will figure it out. And I think the time span in which it will do so is actually on the order of just a few years, because it's getting much, much smarter. And maybe it's not AGI, but definitely it's going to be more intelligent than humans in terms of doing science. So it will get left in the dust, and maybe it's a good thing. Let's just let the robots do the work. So.
One of the questions on Moneyfold is, will human intelligence solve longevity before AGI does? So please start predicting on that too.
I put that in there. So.
You put it in there. Good. Please, guys, predict on it.
If I may, I am very opposed to this narrative of competition between artificial and natural intelligence. Right. This is just not the way I see things develop. AI is a tool, right? It's a screwdriver which doesn't do things on itself. We control it, we program it, and it's going to develop symbiotically, right? So it's going to be some sort of augmented intelligence that will solve longevity, not human or artificial.
Well, and there I'm really glad that we have Brett here from Cortical Labs, who's definitely working on that merger. I'm going to ask you one more question, and then if anyone from the audience has any questions, feel free to raise your hand in a sec. But, you know, in order to foreshadow a little bit of the things that we're discussing tomorrow as well, in the Realpolitik discussion, like, if you think of like the non-technical bottlenecks for a while, like, you know, the things that always get discussed, what is one thing that, you know, you think this field really needs? I know that we've seen a lot of discussion and like really like progress on biomarker standardization, which usually often comes up, you know, like, is that one you think is important? Do you think something else needs to really be done field wide to like actually, to bring it forward?
So right now with the big gold rush in AI, there is a shortage of GPUs, shortage of A100s. So I think that problem needs to be solved in order for progress in machine learning for longevity to actually be able to go forward. There's a bottleneck. It's very hard to get A100s. One approach that we've tried to do in my work with Altos Labs is that we've contributed heavily to DCubeX, which is kind of MLOps platform that tries to kind of find the most cost-effective GPUs and get them for us. But we need more A100s. We need a lot more GPUs. And that's going to be very hard to solve because of all the geopolitical problems with Taiwan.
Yeah, I guess who doesn't? I think another related factor is also that, like, you know, you've seen a lot of people from AI move into longevity in the past few years, and now they're moving back into AI because they actually think that one of the fastest ways to solve most of the longevity problems is by just literally working back in AI. So that's one. Another one?
So I think that whatever model of AI we have is not as important as the data that goes to be analyzed and modeled. And a critical need is what I would call data hygiene, data quality standards, which are completely lacking in the field. If today you want to go and pull the data from hundreds or thousands of papers to co-analyze it, it's just impossible. Not hard, not expensive, just completely impossible. All right. So introducing data standards, finding a way to get people to submit their code in their data with publications so that we move away from being the field of humanity, creating fun stories for journalists into actual hard science, finally, is, I think that's...
Very hard plus one on that. You're completely right. And there's so much depth to what you're saying, because there's layers upon layers. So one is that academic labs don't want to share data. It's against their culture. Even when you try to change the culture, it takes time for people to change. So they're hesitant to share data. Then once you convince them with a lot of time to actually share their data, suddenly you have different file formats. Those aren't standardized. Different file formats, different metadata. The metadata that everyone uses is so different. And then even if you can match up the file formats and the metadata, even if you do all of those things, which by the way takes a lot of time because a lot of people are still keeping all their data on little flash drives. So once you do that, even then a lot of the data, the experiments will run slightly differently enough that you can't really generalize. So what I'm seeing most longevity companies in this space do is they raise a lot of funding and then they throw out all the old data and then they create all new data, which is incredibly inefficient.
Any other societal bottleneck you want to pinpoint to?
Well, I guess a bit of a different challenge that I see to the field in general is just how small we are. I think if we had, 10 times or 100 more times more people, actual scientists going into the field, I think it'd be much more efficient and less prone to like this groupthink that I think sometimes we're prone to. And I think this is a problem of, first of all, visibility in terms of the like, how the bigger field of biology perceives longevity. And it's just the young people, I think, very few have this incentive to go into aging. At least that's not their first choice. So maybe that's something that we also need to try to change to recruit more people, recruit more young people into the field and just, grow the actual people doing the science. So
I think it's true. And nevertheless, if I compare longevity with our neurotech projects, or if I compare it with our molecular machines track, it's like has gotten so much more progress in the last week, or just attention at least. Are there any audience questions? Anything you want to? Yes, just shout it out because we can't move the mic over there.
As a software engineer, I feel actually very confused by this coordination problem in science. I feel that it came up already in the beginning of your discussion. First mentioned how AI can contribute. It feels like the main problem is that the human aspect of this cannot really coalesce into a super intelligent composing in labs in an efficient manner. For all the problems that you mentioned now,
You're just confused. Is there like a specific question in it?
Well, the question here is like, okay, so what's the complete picture here? Why do we have this kind of culture in science? How can we address it more systematically? You mentioned a bunch of aspects of it. Is there an underlying factor that can connect them all?
Well, maybe Altus Labs is trying to address this. They just kind of vacuumed up all of the top scientists in the field, and then they're trying to change the culture and saying, don't do things like you did in the lab. Let's all share data, and maybe Alexander can speak to
it. Yeah, so I spent the past year working with Altus Labs to fix this issue, which is why I'm so passionate about it. They did take something like 40 plus private labs over the world and privatize them. And that's when I say it takes time to change the culture. I'm talking from personal experience. That first people have this emotional kind of feeling of, I can't share my data. And finally, 2 years into Altus's creation, they finally move past that and they're excited to work with each other. But then there's still the technical aspects. So many of them said had data on hard disks or flash drives or these various ways. And so I've spent the last year developing a centralized database that can store all of this. So that's taken a lot of time, quite frankly. And then, like I mentioned, the metadata doesn't line up. The way that they did the experiments doesn't quite line up. You end up really having to develop a centralized database and a standardized metadata. then have everyone start from scratch with all of the new and generate new genomics data, new microscopy data, new mass spec data, and start from the drawing board, right? And that's going to take time for them to run all the experiments and do everything. So I'm very optimistic that that good research will come. But there have been people who have been kind of sitting, waiting for something incredible. And it takes longer than you think because of these coordination problems. I think these problems could be solved by having these companies run more like tech companies and less like academia. And I'm very passionate about kind of having a strong COO, strong CTO at many of these companies that kind of set these technological standards and processes from the beginning. Instead of, for example, some companies will start with academics and a year later hire their first software engineer. I think we need software engineers in the room from the day one so they could develop the systems alongside the scientists. This may sound obvious to you, but this is actually not how it's being done in the industry. And I'm very passionate, and I think this could really accelerate a lot of the work.
So we're at the vision weekend here. I can suggest one vision that I think would change how things are and solve this problem potentially. I actually suggested it to somebody I'm not going to name, who a wealthy person who said, how do I make impact and change things in the field, right? So today the life cycle of a scientific project is that I propose something, I get funded, I measure, I run an experiment, collect the measurements, and then I spend the next 3 years trying to publish that. So not to be scooped, I hug my data. By the time my paper is out, the data and the theory behind it is probably outdated, right? And it goes somewhere to die. Now imagine that, and I should say that NIH and other funding agencies do require, when I publish, that I deposit the raw data. This is a beautiful idea and a terrible implementation. I would actually establish a funding mechanism where I get paid to immediately release the data the moment it is measured, right? Whether because maybe I'm hit by a bus, maybe something happens that, right? So if I get the money, as soon as I start my experiment, I go and I define publicly what am I measuring, why am I measuring. As soon as I get data points, it is public. Then I could interpret it, take, comment, take it back. I don't see why this is not possible, and I believe this would very much change how we operate.
We have that internally.
Internally, within Altus.
Let's all join Altus Labs.
That's the last 2 years.
Okay, we have two more questions, and then I want to get into the prediction questions over here. Over here, and then you had one, Jonathan, right? Yeah, go for it.
So, can you open source a lab notebook? So I've gone through the process of picturing your lab notebook to solve all these problems, right? And we still use a combination of Notion and our own database and other crap.
Yeah.
There's no, I looked at, this is fundamental. You're talking about
lab notebook. Right. So,
thank you very much. Right. We still do not have a good way to share the lab protocol and results.
Right? And there's no lab notebook that many people claim to have. There's really no lab notebook. It's only 2 to 3 quarters a year old, but there's no lab notebook that actually uses LLMs properly.
So,
it's an obvious combination.
So, here's what we're doing. Scientists want to use benchling because that's what they're used to. And in benchling, we have a standardized template that we have gotten the scientists to all agree to use, which is not easy because it's 350 people with different opinions. They have a standardized benchling notebook. And that is when they create a notebook that is automatically converted into a data package that is stored in our centralized database. And we do have LLMs that are working on that.
But they're running on that. Actually very expensive for, let's say, for, it's difficult for smaller companies.
Yeah. So even if you use something else, we use benchling, but if you use something else, you could still easily use
LLMs. Open source the tools that are not the benchling part, I guess.
Everyone's making very common here.
We are, I work at FDA, we are trying to develop a lot of open source tools. We have a good chemical database that can capture a little bit of bioassay data. We're trying to standardize bioassay data. Even, the data we get in is very variable. And the number of tests we get, we're trying to standardize on in vitro pharmacology data, all the safety tests, mostly small molecules, SIP and transporter profiling, and then also describing the assays in a consistent manner. because bioassays are just inherently variable. And there's all kinds of parameters that you never really standardize and stuff like that. So we distribute a system called Global Substance Registration System that's absolutely free. And a lot of regulators are using it. EMA is using it. We're using it. We developed it in collaboration with NCATS, National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences. And then they're doing some stuff on that. And they're a good resource if you're a small company to get testing done and things like that. So there's a lot of stuff out there. It's completely open source, our system. It's not GitHub. I mean, I'm not a software developer, but I've been sort of managing the system for about 10 years. And we have all the drugs that have been in clinical trials that we know about. We link them to clinical trials. We link them to adverse events. We can't link them to show the application data because that's, of course, private. But we link all the approved drugs to that. And it's very difficult to even say, we're trying to standardize medicinal product data around the world. Right? These are things that are on the market and what the elements are. And that's been a project for 20 years. We're still getting there, but the metadata and things like that, there are efforts to do that. I mean, there's the bioassay quarter, but Leon's right. I mean, NLM with PubChem and all that, had a repository, and it's almost useless. I mean, there's tons of data there, but trying to find what's relevant or what's reliable is very, trying to aggregate it in a way that's useful is very difficult.
Another question over here.
Yeah, I guess, from the panel, discussion, this is to be free. The issues is the aligning the practices, the technical issues that you were mentioning, aligning the tools and the funding. What's the biggest hurdle, right? Especially in terms of funding, right? What prevents the big funding organizations just enforce more of these rules upstream? Is there anything from the community blocking it, or is it just the funders not being aware? What's the big lever that you can use to change it?
I have no idea how NIH works within. There is a lot of inertia.
Because it seems to me that if the funders expect these things, then the money is going to funnel down to maybe improving the tools, and then the practices are going to emerge once the tools are there and everyone's adopting the same pipeline.
From what I've seen, there's a lot of funding. For example, Altos Lab started with $3 billion, right? So it's not a problem of funding. And the GPU shortage, for example, we have this workaround with DQBEX, like I mentioned. And so the problem remains that the funders give this $3 billion, for example. I'm not talking about any particular company, but they give money. They step away. They put someone in charge, usually a scientist, and scientists don't know how to run tech companies. And to me, that's the biggest that's the single biggest issue that we could solve, because I don't think the problems in the space, I don't think that they're that the biggest problems, the biggest challenges, they are not researched. I think they are operations.
Great. I love that we're already getting into the societal discussion of tomorrow. I want to just leave some time to get to a few of the spicy manifold questions, and I want to have us all chime in on them here, starting perhaps with the panel. So one of them is, which intervention will add the most years of life to healthy people in 5 years of research? We have a few examples here: telomeric stemming therapies, stem cell therapies, somatic reprogramming, surgeon targeting therapies, senolytics, rapamycin supplementation, plasma blood-based therapies, organ replacement, NAD-targeted therapies, and microbiome replacement, genetic medicine, calorie restriction. Not many people predicted here. So let's just start with the panelists. Which of those do you think is the most promising? Or if you think none of them, then you already mentioned organ replacement. Perhaps that's not all the way 5 years out, but anyone, any comments on this?
Well, I'm not sure if somatic reprogramming is what meant to be partial reprogramming.
It's from the longevity biotech bottleneck survey. And so they rephrased it a little, it's their language. Okay. And they explained it a little bit more in detail there.
Right.
So yes,
I'm obviously biased because I'm working on reprogramming and I think it is the most promising of the existing approaches. So definitely I would go with that.
Okay. Anyone here?
None. I think that we're under enormous pressure from entrepreneurs to turn questionable science into products. So unfortunately, I'm hopeful about some scientific directions which might become interventions eventually, but today, nothing.
I wish I had added a non in there next time, Leon. Next time, just for you, Alex. No? Okay.
I did.
Anyone here wants to venture out? What do you think is really promising there?
We disagree with each other. So which one of us do you agree with?
I mean, cellular reprogramming seems like a good avenue. And also, I hadn't heard about ECM until yesterday when you told me about it. But again, I'm more gung-ho on the AI portions of it. And I know less about the biology.
Fair enough. All right. The artificial womb question. Will an artificial womb deliver a human baby by... starting with 2025, 4%, 2040, the highest mark so far, 80%. Does anyone have a, who here thinks it's going to be 2025? 2028? Ooh, I like it. Okay, 2031. Okay, more. 2034, and everything that is after that counts as dead. Okay, wow, okay. So people are more optimistic than actually manifold, I think. 2037? 2040. Okay, cool. Well, good. Love the read of the room. All right, let's see if we have another spicy one in here that I'd love you guys' take on. Please also start predicting. That would be really wonderful because I think that and start adding your questions to it. That would be absolutely amazing. Okay, so we have this one here. First question is, are you in favor of indefinite life extension or are you mostly in favor of health span extension? Let's just start with that one here.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a maximalist. I'm all for making death optional and stopping aging. So in the meantime, of course, you know, health span extension as the kind of the minimal goal, I'm all for it. So, but of course, I think anybody who says our ultimate goal is not defeating aging, I'm not sure how they have this cognitive dissonance. They're like, yeah, I want to be healthy until 200 and just, anyways.
What do you think?
I think this question reminds me of discussions of ethical time travel and environmentally friendly teleportation. We so far from extending life that it's just impossible to imagine indefinite life extension. So I don't really know what this means, but sure, I'm in favor.
We're in a philosophy armchair here. You can venture all the way out. Indefinite just helps then. Okay, let's just maybe do a show of hand. Who is in favor of indefinite life extension? Anyone? Just like, let's just stick with health span extension. I guess LEV is kind of like eventually leading to that. Anyone just like, let's just do health span. Fair enough. You guys also, you guys have a point. If we only got that, we'd also all be pretty happy already. Do you think any of these arguments by skeptics are the ones that you really want to bust? Yes, I'll... So if you're in favor of indefinite life extension, what are the biggest myths to bust for skeptics? Indefinite life extension would make life boring, meaningless. Indefinite life extension would lead to overpopulation. Indefinite life extension would increase wealth disparities. Indefinite life extension would lead to power consolidation, or it would lead to culture decay and slowing down of progress, like the science advances one funeral at a time question.
Yeah, well, obviously overpopulation is the most, you know, everybody's favorite objection when they first hear of life extension, and it's the biggest myth.
It is.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we're not going to overpopulate the planet just because people are going to stop dying. And even at this point, we're already facing
the opposite
potential
problem.
Yeah, the depopulation.
I would say for a change, I agree with you. But it comes from some sort of a very naive picture where we suddenly indefinitely extend life but remain at the same level of primitive technology everywhere else, right? You cannot imagine that. If we're advanced enough to extend life, we're probably advanced enough to change the desert to a livable place, to very easily produce food and medicine, and to do a bunch of other things, right? They usually go hand in hand.
So it's a general lack of imagination. And do you want to speak to it or...
No, I also think overpopulation is a huge myth, and I am worried about depopulation. Another reason why I care so much about artificial wounds, it all comes back together.
Wonderful. Okay, so we're almost at time. I just want to...
Power consolidation?
Infinite Putin.
Hashtag infinite Putin.
It's not a biggest myth. I think... I guess... it's a valid concern, but condemning 8 billion people to keep dying just because you're worried about 3 dictators or 4 dictators staying in power, I think it's silly. And it's not like we have right now a magic way to change dictatorship. Putin dies, there's going to be another dictator. So, yeah, this is silly. Like, let's stop scientific progress just because people are going to live longer, including dictators. I think it's a very Great. Silly...
Let's maybe close it here. I want to hear from you in the closing thoughts. Just after, we're going to have the Molecular Machines panel come up here in a second. But after that, we're going to have a combined speaker meet and greet. So if there's one thing people should really be seeking you out for, like one thing that you find undervalued, one spicy topic that you want to discuss with people, what would that be?
I'm really annoyed by people asking, are we there yet? You know, when are we going to have the cure?
You know what to not ask you.
There's so many ways to actually bring it closer. Get involved. There's citizen science. There's in many forms of activism in addition to just sending the money to the field. And yeah, talk to me if you want ideas.
Cool. Alex.
Yep. I like talking about operations and how to make sure that tech companies run effectively so that you're not wasting a year just trying to fix DevOps before you can launch any apps in your company, for example. Not that I'm speaking from personal experience or anything.
I can talk about partial reprogramming. If you're skeptical about reprogramming, I can maybe convince you to be less skeptical. I can talk to Leon about that. Also myths. Yeah. Happy to talk to people about, you know, objections to extending lifespan. And if you're in general opposed to indefinite life extension, I'm happy to talk to you, maybe try to convince you that you shouldn't be.
Wonderful. Okay. If you want to know any more about the biotechnology field, we have a lot of different areas out here. We have the Longevity Prize. We have the report from our previous workshop that's also lying out here. So if you want to dig deeper, there's the seminar series that are all in summaries here. You can meet our fellows in that field. And we have lots of publications and a very rich longevity tech tree. That's the one that's perhaps the furthest built out. So if you just want to kind of like take a peek about what that field, all of it that it involves, it has a pretty good exocellular matrix section, and then it goes all the way into head transplants and whatnot. So it's pretty built out. So if you want to know more about that, please feel free to dive in. But yes.
I just want to take a second to say that there is practical longevity session tonight. So please come.
Tonight we're going to have a personal self-experiment session for those who stay at the Chateau and our speakers and fellows. And it's going to be pretty hands-on. Okay, thank you so much for our first panel. We're going to do a quick switch to Molecular Machines. So if you're on that panel, meet me up on stage and we're going to start in a minute. Thank you so much.